Hi, Dave Emery here. This is side one of, for the record, program number 799, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This is being recorded on June 22nd of the year 2014. Well, happy summer. These aren't the lazy or hazy days of summer, but they sure are crazy. Of course, a reference to the old Nat King Cole song, which is redundant. There are some truly insane things going on in the world, and perhaps the craziest thing about them is that nobody is really saying, hey, you know what? That is insane. Those people are out of their bleeping minds. We're going to begin by taking a look at the effects of austerity on the European voting electorate. We're going to, in particular, take a shocking look at a follow-up to, for the record, 788. I titled that one Greek Tragedy, Part 2, Clausewitzian Economics, and the continuation of war by other means. We're going to take a look at who the new health minister in Greece is, and also we're going to take a look at the fact that what is happening in Greece appears to be happening elsewhere as well. Some years back, we did a number of programs, both interviews and text excerpts of the book The Beast Reawakens by Martin Lee. And in that book, he quoted one analyst as observing that fascism is like a virus. It mutates and assumes new forms, and in that regard, it sort of escapes the collective political immune system, so to speak. Much of this program is going to be taking a look at, I guess what one could say, that mutating virus. We're going to be taking a look at fascism masquerading or marching under the banner of, would be a better way, of freedom and libertarianism and don't fence me in and give me my rights. Remember that Mussolini observed that, quote, il fascismo e il corporatismo, fascism is corporatism, and if you take away all the rules, you take away all the regulatory agencies and so forth, what you have basically is might makes right. You have the golden rule. He who has gold rules. Those who are powerful will impose their power on others. Remember what Lord Acton said, power corrupts. I believe it was Lord Acton. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And we're going to be taking a look at why people have always, perhaps sometimes too late, perhaps after sometimes receiving a very bitter and costly lesson, why people have turned to government in order to protect the modest and the weak from the depredations of those who are wealthy and consequently powerful. It would seem that, as one appropriately enough German analyst once said, history teaches us that we learn nothing from history. So hopefully we will learn something here. Here is lesson number one. This comes from Pando Daily, another important and very useful article by Mark Ames, A-M-E-S. This from Pando Daily of June 15th of 2014. In For the Record 788, we talked about the Laos Party. That was a Greek neo-fascist party. It's spelled L-A-O-S, all in capitals, has nothing to do with a country in Southeast Asia. This is an explicitly fascist and anti-Semitic party. And one of the people associated with it who became the Minister of Infrastructure was a guy named Makis, M-A-K-I-S, Voridis, V-O-R-I-D-I-S. Well, he is back. His nickname is The Hammer, and The Hammer is putting it down, I guess you could say. This Mark Ames article from Pando Daily of June 15th of 2014, Yacht Apps and Anti-Semitic Ministers in the Birthplace of Democracy, it reads in part, skipping down. Now, the bad news. Greece's pro-EU ruling conservative party, the New Democrats, just named an actual neo-Nazi, Makis, The Hammer, Voridis as Greece's new health minister. Jewish groups are outraged over the news that Voridis, a longtime neo-fascist activist and anti-Semite who has publicly promoted the protocols of the Elders of Zion as worthy of scholarship, and at the same time doubted the authenticity of the Diary of Anne Frank, is serving as a prominent minister in the ruling party's cabinet in charge of an important ministry at a time when Greece has been gutting its health care budgets, causing widespread misery. And by the way, interrupting briefly, the draconian state of health care in Greece is such that phys ed teachers are not requiring their students to participate because so many of them are underfed. They get dizzy if they participate in physical education. People who have to go to the hospital in Greece have to bring their own sheets and pillowcases because basically the cleaning staffs have been cut so drastically that they can't afford to wash the bedclothes. People in Greece, only wealthy people can afford to bury their dead. And diseases of all kinds are soaring. So when you see a guy like Makis the Hammer Voridis being imposed or being appointed health minister by the new Democrats or New Democracy, a relatively, quote, mainstream, unquote, center-right party, this is very significant indeed. This is von Clausewitzian health care, the continuation of war by other means. Mark Ames continues with his article. I wrote about Voridis in November of 2011 because I was shocked that the government coalition essentially imposed on Greece by Germany, the EU, and Western creditors would demand that the allegedly technocratic, quote, austerity coalition, unquote, included members of Greece's anti-Semitic, neo-fascist Laos party, including Makis the Hammer Voridis, who served as Minister of Infrastructure and Transport. I call him the Hammer because photographs surfaced showing Voridis as a University of Athens law student carrying a makeshift stone hammer in hand, which he used to bash suspected left-wing students with. That was in 1985, when Voridis was in a fascist group called Student Alternative, unquote, which supported Greece's bloody military coup and the military junta that ruled from 1967 to 1974. Voridis was expelled from law school for clubbing leftist students and went on to big things in the world of neo-fascist Greek politics. Listen to some of his political curriculum vitae here. And again, this guy is now the health minister of Greece, and he is going to be imposing conditions on that sorely beset country, some of the features of which I enumerated just a minute ago. Voridis was expelled from law school for clubbing leftist students and went on to big things in the world of neo-fascist Greek politics. In 1994, he founded the far-right Hellenic Front, which in 2004 formed a coalition with a self-described Nazi, Konstantin Pleveris, or Pleveris, P-L-E-Y-R-I-S, who openly advocated for the extermination of Greece's remaining Jews. In 2005, Voridis merged his party into the Laos Party, whose leader, George Kavatsaferis, publicly mocked Auschwitz and Dachau death camps as myths, unquote, blamed Jews for 9/11 during a speech in Parliament, and said, quote, the Jews have no legitimacy to speak in Greece, unquote. In late 2011, as Greece's politics collapsed under the weight of its debts and the harsh EU-imposed austerity measures, the EU imposed a new, quote, austerity government, unquote, that included the Hammer Voridis and other members of the neo-fascist Laos Party. The austerity government ran Greece until new elections were called in mid-2012. In those interim months, the austerity coalition pushed through radical austerity measures that caused Laos's fascist voters to desert them for an even more violent, more extreme neo-Nazi party, the Golden Dawn Party. One would have thought that would be the end of Makis Voridis. But Voridis is one of the slyer fascists. He joined the austerity cabinet and served from November of 2011 through June of 2012. In the June 2012 elections, after Laos was obliterated for participating in that austerity government, Farides abandoned Laos and joined the new ruling party that won the elections, the respectable right-wing New Democracy Party. And now, New Democracy is paying back the favor to their favorite austerity fascist. Parenthetically, keep your eyes peeled in this country. If the Republicans win the 2016 elections and carry both houses of Congress, you will see something very similar in this country as well. So as they used to say in old-time radio, stay tuned. What austerity has been doing in Greece, it is also doing elsewhere in Europe. To make a very, very long story very, very short, when the people are economically deprived, when they are hungry, when they need material goods that they must have, clothing, housing, medical care, and other things, that increases what psychologists and social biologists refer to as appetitive behavior, specifically a part of the brain called the limbic system with the hippocampus and the amygdala is activated, and appetitive behaviors, or the drive for appetitive behaviors, increase. Appetitive, deriving from appetite. You get hungry if you need food, if you need sleep, if you need shelter, if you need warmth, if you need sex, any of these things. If you ain't getting them, you will turn nasty. And where fascism has been very successful is in offering people a human target on which to blame their distress, which is rooted in basically not getting enough and feeling lousy because of that. This is happening all over Europe, and not just in Europe. The Daily Beast of June 8th, 2014, a relatively staid block, frankly, certainly no screaming left-wing publication by any means, has an article called, and listen to this very carefully, because the Daily Beast is really pretty tame and pretty mainstream. I guess you could say the Daily Beast is a tame Daily Beast. Fascism is fashionable again in Europe, by Thane Rosenbaum. Parenthetically, for how long have I been talking about this? How long have I been warning about it? Now, even the Daily Beast can no longer ignore this. Again, by Thane Rosenbaum, Daily Beast, June 8th of this year, 2014, fascism is fashionable again in Europe. It reads in part, fascism is back in fashion throughout nearly all of Europe. Elections for the European Parliament with ballots cast in 28 countries produced a startling victory for the sort of political parties that are normally not invited to fashionable parties. In some countries like France, where fashion always matters, the voters gave the boorish National Front the largest share of votes, skipping down. Things were only slightly better in Austria, Denmark, and Sweden. In Hungary, the demonstrably anti-Semitic Jobbik Party finished second. In Greece, the Golden Dawn Party, a neo-Nazi outfit that dresses in what looks like Nazi uniforms, captured seats for the first time. Even in Germany, where Nazi memorabilia and romanticism are outlawed, a neo-fascist claimed a seat. All across the Atlantic, the fringe is looking more and more like the mainstream. These groups are generally united in their thuggery and their xenophobia. Openly racist, anti-immigrant, and anti-Semitic feelings seem to be the first plank atop each party's platform. To be sure, economic recession, the ongoing European debt crisis, and high unemployment contributed to this dash toward extremism, but anti-foreign rhetoric ultimately dominated the campaigns. Hating the other has become a European rallying cry, I would say, parenthetically interjecting. The same, obviously, is happening in the U.S. as well. More about that later. These parliamentary results, however, were not that difficult to predict for anyone paying attention to the vulgar events that have overtaken the continent lately. This past September in Greece, a man sympathetic to Golden Dawn's stump speeches murdered Pavlos Fissas, F-Y-S-S-A-S, a left-wing rapper better known by his hip-hop handle, Killer P. Like the stormtroopers of old, Golden Dawn, the fastest-growing party in Greece, can't seem to make an appearance without a riot breaking out, openly invoking Nazism and Hitler as their primary political influences. They even have a logo that resembles a swastika. A Belgian political party, Stand Up Belge, B-E-L-G-E-S, has gained followers. A day before the election, three people were murdered and one critically wounded at the Jewish Museum in Brussels. Less than a month earlier, there was a planned, quote, gathering of dissidents, unquote, featuring an assortment of Nazi-endy characters. The protest was banned, but not before the crowd performed the Quenelle, Q-E-N-E-L-L-E, en masse, popularized by French comic Diodon Mbala Mbala. The gesture has become a trendy symbol among those who would otherwise fetishize Heil Hitler. Speaking of Diodon, he has been convicted 7 times in France for preaching anti-Semitism and boasts a personal friendship with Jean-Marie Le Pen, the founder of the National Front. Diodon's act has included dressing up as a rabbi and giving a Nazi salute. Recently on stage, he warned a French Jewish radio host, quote, "If winds change, I think to myself, well, the gas chambers, too bad," unquote. On February 1st, his supporters held a demonstration purportedly against the French president, but the protest descended into an old-style pogrom when the crowd chanted, "Jew, France is not yours," unquote. Such are the polemics of European hate, which no one takes seriously until it's time to take it seriously. The economic conditions and political landscape throughout the continent are starting to look a lot like the 1930s, which, despite what Winston Churchill said about his own country at the time, was not Europe's finest hour, unquote. And again, the EU and the EMU are basically the realizations of a pan-German goal for worldwide domination through economic and political domination of continental Europe that actually had their genesis back in the 19th century with Friedrich List, and they have been realized over 100-plus years through a series of wars and what Karl von Clausewitz referred to as post-wars, an altogether persevering and, frankly, very brilliant strategy, albeit one that is consummately cynical as it is turning out to be successful. Parenthetically, when I talk about an underground Reich, people, I mean an underground Reich. That is not some sort of rhetorical flourish. That's why I have the old anti-fascist books available on my website, as well as long article-length descriptions of all of these programs. These programs are meant to be read as well as listened to. So spitfirelist.com, my entire life's work is up there for download for free. We are going to be talking about the mutating virus of fascism and how this right-wing corporatist totalitarian system is manifesting itself under the banner of freedom and liberation and libertarianism and no rules, and won't this be fun? We've been talking about Bitcoin. It is billed as a crypto online currency. It's actually just computer code. No one knows who made it. There is no Satoshi Nakamoto. The vast majority of ownership is also relatively anonymous. In For the Record 760, the first of our programs about Bitcoin, I think, frankly, that we nailed it. Bitcoin appears to have been developed by people from a company called Arontic, which is a subsidiary and knockoff of Siemens, the German electronics giant that is inextricably linked with the Bormann Capital Network and also with BND, German intelligence. Siemens serves as something of a quartermaster for German intelligence. Lontic, by the way, was capitalized by Golden Gate Capital, which in turn was formed by alumni of Bain Capital. That's Mitt Romney's company as well. Well, I guess you could say, here we go again. As this particular article, also from the very useful Pando Daily, this from June 16th of 2014, guess what? There is once again a threatening concentration of ownership and control in the Bitcoin community, and the company that appears to be monopolizing Bitcoin with all sorts of potentially catastrophic consequences for this online currency is a company called Ghash.io, which is in turn controlled by CEX, all in capitals, .io. That, by the way, is a mysterious Netherlands company with a London mailing address. And, well, we can only wonder who that might be. Now, once again, here we go again. This is from the Pando Daily, June 16th of 2014. Article by Michael Carney, C-A-R-N-E-Y. Crypto Armageddon. Researchers claim mining concentration threatens to destroy Bitcoin. And it reads in part, here we go again. For the umpteenth time in recent memory, the sanctity of the Bitcoin network is facing an existential threat from a large and overly secretive organization. It's not an exchange or wallet service this time around that has the attention of cryptocurrency watchers, but rather a large mining pool, specifically Ghash.io, the self-described world's number one crypto and Bitcoin mining pool. So why is the Bitcoin world up in arms over Ghash? On several occasions last week, one lasting a full 12 hours, the group, which is owned by cloud mining service CEX.io, controlled more than 50% of the global computational power directed at mining Bitcoin. With such control, Ghash, or any group that finds itself in a similar position, could manipulate the integrity of the Bitcoin network by potentially double-spending coins, blocking or reversing transactions by competing miners, extorting increased transaction processing fees from the network, or waging a distributed denial-of-service attack against the entire Bitcoin network, collectively a so-called 51% attack, unquote. In other words, it's a major threat to Bitcoin's foundational, distributed, and therefore trustless nature. Cornell researchers Itayal, I-T-T-A-Y, last name capital E-Y-A-L, and Amin Gunjiwen Sirer, or Sirer, S-I-R-E-R, were the first to recognize the 51% event, calling it, quote, Armageddon, unquote, in a Friday blog post, and describing Ghash as a de facto monopoly, unquote. The pair, who have long been thought to be leaders on the concepts of 51% attacks and selfish mining, write, Ghash is in a position to exercise complete control over which transactions appear on the blockchain and which miners reap mining rewards. They could keep 100% of the mining profits to themselves if they so chose. Bitcoin is currently an expensive distributed database under the control of a single entity, albeit one that requires constantly burning energy to maintain. Worst of all worlds. It's an historical first for any entity to cross the 50% threshold, although Ghash has been close before, approaching 45% in January of this year. At the time, Ghash issued a press release publicly committing to never reaching the feared 51% threshold, really anything greater than 50%. So much for that promise. To be clear, Ghash doesn't own 50% of the global mining power. It simply, quote, controls it, unquote. This distinction is important, but does not necessarily eliminate the threat the group poses. Ghash has in the past claimed to own only half the hardware providing the hashing power that it controls, with the rest controlled by third-party miners that allocate mining power to its pool. Nonetheless, the Bitcoin network has reason to be fearful of this concentration of power. Making matters worse, no one knows who is behind GHASH or CEX. The owners of CEX, the Netherlands-based company which lists a London mailing address, are notoriously secretive, meaning that the Bitcoin community, which at this point represents several $1 billion in wealth and untold future value, are left trusting a shadowy entity not to behave badly with its newfound power. This last sentence again, because this really, I think, not only sums up Bitcoin, but at the foundation of Bitcoin is the Austrian School of Economics, people like Friedrich von Hayek, whom we spoke about last week, Ludwig von Mises, whom we spoke about last week, Hans Hermann Hoppe. These are people who explicitly reject democracy. Some of them are favorable to slavery. The milieu is favorable to slavery. This is also the milieu of which Edward Snowden is part. It's the milieu of which Julian Assange is part. It's the milieu of which Ron and Rand Paul are part. Rand Paul now being touted by Ralph Nader. One more time, this last sentence. The owners of CEX, the Netherlands-based company which lists a London mailing address, are notoriously secretive, meaning that the Bitcoin community, which at this point represents several $1 billion in wealth and untold future value, are left trusting a shadowy entity not to behave badly with its newfound power. Again, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Another indication of Bitcoin madness, and the authors conclude, all of these are precisely the points we cautioned about. So this is when we get to say, we told you so. That, again, the authors of the analysis being quoted here in Pando Daily. Guess what the new application of Bitcoin is going to be? USA Today, from May 9th through 11th of 2014, their weekend edition, an article by Frederica Schouten, Frederica Schouten, Politics Jumps on the Bitcoin Wagon, unquote. The Federal Election Commission unanimously approved its use as a political donation Thursday. Commissioners imposed several conditions. Among them, no anonymous Bitcoin contributions will be allowed, and campaign treasurers must scrutinize the donations for, quote, evidence of illegality, unquote. Jim Harper of the industry's Bitcoin Foundation said that the FEC's move gives further legitimacy to the currency. It's another part of the growing body of regulation that establishes Bitcoin as a co-equal of the financial services system, he said. I'm skipping down. It's not clear how quickly the currency will spread through the election landscape. Officials with the committee working to elect House Democrats said they had no immediate plans to accept Bitcoins. And one fellow, quote, praised the FEC for its forward-looking stance to recognize the rights of individuals seeking alternatives to government-backed currencies to participate in our democratic political process. Well, if CEX sounds democratic to you, I feel sorry for you. We're going to talk more about fascism marching under the banner of freedom or libertarianism in Side 2. This, however, concludes Side 1 of For the Record Program number 799. Miscellaneous articles and updates being recorded on June 22nd of 2014. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.